ش تومور اسرائیل.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
The recent high prices cannot be really be justified. The Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade, Market Regulators, Basij, and the other organizations in charge, such as Customs and others, should cooperate with one another to eliminate this problem for the people. All these issues are controllable. Therefore, with coordinated management on the part of these organizations, these problems can be resolved. As for security, the main point is foreign security, as the country should be equipped with defensive equipment such as missiles, drones, planes, and the like, and they're easy building them. Such equipment guarantees the foreign security of the country. In other words, they protect the country against the enemy's greed. We should not think that all problems can be resolved by building missiles. There are some problems that have nothing to do with missiles, but there are also many problems that are related to these defensive tools.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
As for domestic security, our security organizations should be wary of the enemy's infiltration. The main point is enemy infiltration, his infiltration into different organizations for the sake of tempting individuals. This is the main problem. They should do something to resolve this problem. The same is true of culture. The officials of cultural affairs should make intelligent efforts. Sometimes, the volume of our cultural work is really large, but such activities should be done in an intelligent manner. In other words, we should know what we need in every area and what cultural work we should do, and then we should implement it. In my opinion, if these things are done, the issues related to the economy, security, and culture are three main issues that could be resolved with acumen, harmony, and persistence. Well, officials are thankfully busy working. They should work a little more seriously so that the task will be accomplished.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The coronavirus pandemic is a direct consequence of the imperative for growth at all costs, especially through extractive wealth concentrating capitalism and at the expense of the environment. This should make us all think whether any of us have spent enough time interpreting the world around us and whether our actions have been preceded by thoughtful consideration and debate. The recent U.S. presidential election, in which, as the U.S. media projected, the isolationist America First candidate experienced a crushing defeat, signaled a growing consensus that this unprecedented global emergency requires a global solution. If this is indeed the case, then philosophy can contribute in a great way to the resolution of this crisis. After all, unlike experts who often have a narrow focus and offer localized solutions, philosophy always aspires to address problems from a global perspective. Many renowned philosophers have written about the pandemic and the lessons all peoples of the world could learn from it. But there are some thinkers whose global perspective can especially help stem our obsession to change the world without taking the time to interpret it first. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Santiago Zavala, a research professor of philosophy at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, Spain, under the heading, How Have Philosophers Responded to Pandemic? This article was published on aljazeera.com. Please stay with us to hear more about this issue. In her message to mark World Philosophy Day 2020, UNESCO Director General Audrey Azoulay underlined the exceptional nature of this year's celebration. She said this day is particularly meaningful this year, adding, it gives us the opportunity to celebrate much more than an academic discipline or a human science, but a certain way of being in the world made all the more necessary by the context in which we live today. Of course, the context Azoulay was referring to is the coronavirus pandemic that has touched every aspect of our lives. Indeed, from Barcelona to Baghdad, COVID-19 has radically altered the daily routines of everyone, that is, their being in the world. Unlike the suspicious September 11 attacks and 2008 financial crisis, the first two supposedly global events of 21st century, this pandemic has not spared anyone anywhere, and its consequences will continue to be felt for decades in every corner of the world. The global nature of this emergency has compelled everyone to contribute to the efforts to end it either professionally or in a personal capacity. While immunologists, doctors, and nurses become indispensable in the quest to develop vaccines and assist patients, others contributed simply by wearing masks and offering to help their vulnerable neighbors during lockdowns. But how have philosophers contributed? Can the love for wisdom, as it is classically defined, make any difference in a pandemic? The pandemic is a direct consequence of the imperative for growth at all costs, especially through extractive wealth concentrating capitalism and at the expense of the environment. This should make us all think whether any of us have spent enough time interpreting the world around us and whether our actions have been preceded by thoughtful consideration and debate. The recent U.S. presidential election, in which, as the U.S. media projected, the isolationist America First candidate experienced a crushing defeat, signaled a growing consensus that this unprecedented global emergency requires a global solution. If this is indeed the case, then philosophy can contribute in a great way to the resolution of this crisis. After all, unlike experts who often have a narrow focus and offer localized solutions, philosophy always aspires to address problems from a global perspective. Many renowned philosophers such as Judith Butler, Achille Mbembe, and Giorgio Agamben have written about the pandemic and the lessons all peoples of the world could learn from it. But there are two thinkers whose global perspective can especially help stem our obsession to change the world without taking the time to interpret it first: Slavoj Žižek and Bruno Latour. Žižek and Latour do not necessarily agree on how we can overcome this pandemic, but they both offer new ideas and questions that might at least prepare us for the next global emergency. Žižek asserts that the way we deal with this pandemic ultimately depends on our basic stance toward human life. This is why he believes this emergency, more than it has changed the world, has brought us to the fore those issues, such as extreme inequality, the commodified digitization of our lives, and institutional disregard for the environment, that war raging beneath the surface all along. The fact that there are billions of people, from refugees to those trapped in extreme poverty or in war zones, for whom COVID-19 is a comparatively minor issue, is an indication that we are not all in the same boat, as many suggest. This is also evident for those who cannot work from home in safe isolation and must instead spend their day working in supermarkets, distribution depots, factories, and on the streets, protected only by whatever safety measures their employers care to offer them. In order for some to survive in their private quarantine, Žižek explains, many have to risk their lives for nothing more than the smooth functioning of the world capitalist market. According to the Slovenian thinker, the pandemic not only reveals these devastating consequences of capitalism, but also presents an opportunity for the reinvention of new strategies. He's not talking about a possible rebirth of the old-style strategies, but rather a reorganization of global economy which will no longer be at the mercy of market mechanisms. Alongside the viral pandemic, Žižek calls also for a confrontation with the pandemic of inequality and ecological degradation, a reconsideration of our entire stance towards life and nature. This reconsideration is also at the center of Bruno Latour's response to the pandemic. The renowned French philosopher of science suggests that the coronavirus emergency should be understood as a dress rehearsal for the ongoing ecological crisis. He explains the coronavirus epidemic is not simply a standalone health crisis, but part of a much bigger problem, a moment within the ongoing global ecological annihilation. While it might be true that we have now acknowledged the need to fight this virus collectively, This acknowledgement did not expand to the ongoing ecological crisis, as not many have drawn the connection between the continued degradation of the environment and the outbreak of this sickness. According to the French thinker, the pandemic calls for a new definition of society that is not limited to humans among themselves, but also includes other actors who do not have human forms, such as microbes, the internet, the law, the organization of hospitals, the logistics of the state, as well as the climate. Latour believes when this pandemic is over, it will be our obligation to demand from politicians that economic recovery does not bring back the climate policies that created this condition in the first place. The fact that we managed in a few weeks to put our economic system on hold everywhere is a demonstration that it is possible to instantly stop the so-called capitalist strain of progress and create an alternative. As he recently said, if I could change one thing, it would be to get out of the system of production and instead build a political ecology. Both Zizek and Latour, as well as other philosophers who have publicly reflected on this pandemic, concur that this is the time to reconsider our way of being in the world. For too long, we have changed the world too rapidly without thinking carefully about the consequences. This is why both Zizek and Latour welcomed the lockdowns that forced many into a kind of retreat to think, question, and imagine new ways to create a better future. While Zizek's call for a reorganization of global economy and Latour's desire for political ecology might sound unrealistic even during this pandemic, even merely thinking about these ideas could exert enough pressure on us to reconsider our way of being in and interpreting the world.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. According to the International Criminal Court, it has confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity, and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. And what do you think the ICC did when they found out this information? They closed the case. That's right. We will be taking a look at Western privilege in the international arena and the lack of accountabilities for lives lost or destroyed in developing countries in this debate this hour. I'd like to welcome to the program out of London, Press TV's Richard Sudan, and out in Edinburgh, author and commentator John Y. Thank you both for being with us. Starting it off with Richard. Well, Richard, tell me about what's being said on that side of things. It is quite curious that after admitting that there were war crimes committed, that the ICC then closed the case.
I mean, I think, Marzia, in your introduction, you mentioned the phrase Western privilege, and I think that's a really good starting point. I mean, frankly, there are going to be scores of human rights lawyers and experts, scores of anti-war activists that are going to be looking at the decision by the chief prosecutor who said there's no case for the British to answer to with utter disbelief, because in spite of all of the accounts, all of the testimony, all of the evidence that's been put forward, really, in addition to what we already knew, it seems something that, on the one hand, there's been some sort of admission that the British Army military command did indeed contribute to suspected war crimes committed against the Iraqi detainees. But on the other hand, I think the decision mentioned that it's satisfied that the British authorities conducted their own investigation. On what planet, amid what semblance of fairness and true democracy, can the party which is being accused of committing the war crimes somehow be the vindicator that there were none committed? It beggars belief, and I suspect the international community is really looking at this decision with a kind of side-eye squint, also in a sense of disbelief, as are much of the British people.
All right. Well, John, let me get you in on this conversation. What do you make of this? How is that, from a legal perspective, I mean, how does it make sense? So there is a court. The court says, yes, we see proof of war crimes being taken out and that's taken place, and yet the case is closed. And what type of signal, what message does this basically send to the world?
Well, good evening, Amina, and good evening, Richard. There are times when the truth is not enough and when only the unvarnished truth will do. And when we come to an unvarnished truth of this development, let us be honest, this is not about Western privilege per se, this is about white supremacy. The problem disfiguring our world today is not the lack of democracy within states, it's the lack of democracy between states. And this merely confirms it, because what we have are a clutch of Western imperialist countries, of which the UK is a prime member, who do not see themselves as upholders of international laws, but arbiters of international laws, which means to say they get to decide what constitutes war crimes and what does not. And in this case, what we are seeing is the white supremacy of the British imperial state at work. Its soldiers can never be accused or prosecuted for committing war crimes. Because why? Because they're on the good side in this eternal war against the black and brown other. No ifs, no buts, no maybes.
Let me also welcome our next guest. Out of London, author and political commentator, Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Jonathan, the reason the ICC says it is dismissing this is because the UK is investigating itself. Your take on what exactly that means?
Well, there have really been two stages to the British investigation. For several years up until 2017, was something called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, or IHAT. And they had legal teams in court which listened to the claims of people from Iraq who said that they had been tortured or mistreated in various ways. And there were well over 3,000 such claims. And although 70% were dismissed as perhaps unreliable, that still meant that hundreds of people had got legitimate claims. But in fact, the cases fell apart because of the evidence not being strong enough. And instead, what's happened is that now the British military themselves are looking into any prolonged appeals. And it was interesting that the ICC, in its judgment in abandoning the case, now has said that they did believe that the British military were looking at this. But of course, for the victims and their families, there is no justice in this.
Well, now, John, do you think that for international organizations such as the ICC, that the value of lives differ depending on the part of the world one is from?
Oh, indeed, yes. We live in a world underpinned by the values of might is right rather than right is might. And the IEC in this decision has proven itself to be unfit for purpose. We need to move beyond this idea that a certain group of countries based on military might and economic power have the right to determine what is just and what is not just. If these were Iranian troops, if these were Venezuelan troops, if these were Cuban troops involved in these activities or accused of these activities, it would be an entirely different narrative. This is about imperialism, the left's no buts. And I just have to say this. I am appalled as a citizen of the United Kingdom at how dehumanized people of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran have been treated in terms of their value. And they have been pushed outside the circle of human worth that is established in the name of Western imperialism. And this is a very, very sordid and squalid turn of events. And I hope many people in the West will finally wake up to the injustice and the barbarism and the cruelty that has been perpetuated in their name. And unless they do, the world is headed for perdition. This is nothing more than imperial power writ large. There is no justice here. There is no legal pretext here. It's all about power. And until we move beyond that and move into a world where it's about underpinned by justice, regardless of country, regardless of culture, then, I foresee that we're headed for a very bad end.
Jonathan, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says that the UK has been using mechanisms to investigate itself, but then admits that this 10-year investigation has not led to anyone being convicted. It's quite amazing that on the one hand, she's saying that they are capable of actually judging themselves, but on the other hand, no one has been convicted and paid a price. So as our other guest said, would it be the same thing if we were talking about another country such as Iran or, as he said, Venezuela?
Well, it might well be different in those cases. One can't know unless a particular case comes before. As I mentioned earlier, the problem was in the case of British soldiers in Iraq that the evidence was not strong enough linked to individual soldiers or commanders that would actually enable anybody to be successful.
Jonathan, who determined that the evidence was not strong enough? The ICC?
The ICC accepted what the British had, British government and British military had decided through the Iraqi
problem right there.
And that what we have a situation, though, I think we have to admit, and probably John would agree with me on this, is that the real problem is the whole idea of European or North American countries intervening in a situation such as Iraq. Many millions of people, including myself in Britain, demonstrated against the Iraq war and thought it was a terrible mistake. And those sorts of interventions in countries that have a completely different culture and ethnicity and so on almost inevitably lead to various types of abuses. And this is something which I think has to be approached, and I would say in two ways. First of all, that these sorts of interventions should not be entered into as lightly as they have in the past. And secondly, the rules of engagement need to be much more closely monitored so that people are not able to commit the sort of abuses which undoubtedly happened in the case of Iraq.
Jonathan, you're just jumping in here, listening to what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you say that they should not, these countries like the UK, should not be involved or not get involved very easily or lightly in these regions, but of course they do. And on the other hand, the ones who are paying the price are the people of this region, not the aggressors, not the ones that are coming in. At the end of the day, if we're looking at, for example, Iraq, that millions of people have been displaced. That country has never gone back to where it was prior to the war. Yes, Saddam Hussein is gone, but so is security and so many other things. And so many people have been tortured, and so much abuse has taken place. So then the question is, so who pays? Who pays? We're looking right now at the ICC saying, well, the Brits are going to investigate themselves, but these were the same ones, based on a lie, who went into the country to begin with, that they had no right to go into, because, of course, we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I agree, Marzia, absolutely, that the intervention in 2003 was not only unjustified, but as many of us would believe, totally illegal. But we have a situation when you say who is going to pay for what has happened in Iraq, and it is a tragic case. It is unfortunately many of the individual citizens and the communities in Iraq who are paying the price, and it's a terribly high price, which is why there needs to be a complete rethink of, as I said, of engagement in foreign wars and foreign interventions.
Okay. Let me get John back in on this. Yeah. John, do you think that this verdict from the ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, is connected at all to what happened back in September when Bensouda and the ICC ruled that there was enough evidence to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan? And after that ruling, the U.S. sanctioned her. Do you see any type of connection that perhaps there are threats, intimidation being exerted on her? Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, there's absolutely a connection here. I mean, but I just need to go back to something Jonathan said. Jonathan Fry is somebody that I hold in the highest esteem, but I must take exception to his description of the war in Iraq as a mistake. Nomenclature is very important before it unlocks the keys to human consciousness. This war was not a mistake, it was a crime. It was a war crime. It was an atrocity. And the problem that we have in British culture is that every war since the Second World War is perceived and is presented as a rerun of the Second World War, i.e. the good war, i.e. that we are the good guys in this war and that who we are up against are the bad guys. Saddam's Hitler, Rouhani's Hitler, Maduro's Hitler, Castro's Hitler. Do you understand the pattern here? This is national myth presented to the British public as reality. We are the good guys, we are never the bad guys, and our troops can never commit atrocities. Until we break free from these shackles of false consciousness, then I say the world will always be in a perennial state of destabilization, of chaos, of mayhem, and of huge human suffering. Peoples of the global south cannot afford our propaganda any longer because it has been the result, it has been the product of their unremitting suffering. We must bring this to an end, and it's incumbent on people like me and Jonathan to be people in the West, in Britain, to make that case unremittingly, regardless of the personal cost to us and our careers.
Well, Jonathan, when the U.S. treats an international organization in the way that Washington treated the ICC, doesn't it show the lack of sovereignty and legitimacy that perhaps the ICC has to begin with?
Well, of course, the United States and its behavior is a particular case, which one shouldn't generalize with other countries necessarily in Europe. The United States has never been shy of putting pressure on other countries or institutions such as the ICC. And as you know, it refused to engage with the ICC and has withdrawn from other international treaties and organizations because it refuses to accept the universal nature of the international law and the rule of law. And as we've seen with the policy towards Iran, of course, and with maximum pressure under the Trump administration, they are prepared in Washington not only to put pressure from America, but also to coerce other countries to try to get them to follow suit. One hopes this situation will change over the coming months, and certainly there is great resistance amongst many European countries into being coerced in that way, and there's great support for the work of the ICC amongst most European member states.
Well, John, the majority of cases prosecuted by the ICC deal with African countries. This seems to hint at the high level of abuse which has been committed by African leaders. However, if we look at the number of people killed and affected in Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S.-led coalition, one would assume that countries such as the U.K. and the U.S. should be at the top of the agenda of ICC for investigating and prosecuting war crimes. Your thoughts?
Well, Malcolm X said it best, Amina. If you don't understand what's going on in the Congo, you can't understand what's going on in Mississippi. There is a circular relationship between the social and economic injustice taking place in Western countries and the foreign policy of imperialism, colonialism, and oppression that is underway perennially by those same Western countries. And people who are the victims of oppression in those Western countries, until they wake up to the reality of their condition and the whys and wherefores, then there will never be freedom for the rest of the world. And I just hope and pray that people in the US, people, the 40 million who lack healthcare, the families of the over 200,000 who have died from COVID, the families of the over 60,000 who have died from COVID in the UK, they wake up to the reality and move beyond the propaganda, the flag waving, the nationalism, the sense of patriotism. Until they move beyond that, then the world, never mind themselves, but the world will not be free. And I look forward to that day happening soon. I really do hope so.
Well, we all hope so, that's for sure. But Jonathan, when there is so much inequality in the international arena, even the criminal court, doesn't this send a message to developing countries that they must strengthen themselves militarily because might makes right?
Well, I certainly would agree that developing countries have every reason to be disappointed, to put it mildly, in the way that the ICC has tended to focus on Africa. There have been a few other cases recently which are a little more broad, but I would not particularly want to urge countries to spend their scarce resources on yet more military weapons. One of the problems of developing countries, including in Africa, is that too many governments spend far too much on arms and not enough on making sure that their populations are properly fed and educated. So although I can understand the resentment, I think rushing out to buy more arms is not the answer.
Well, your thoughts on that, John, because it seems that that is exactly the signal that is being sent, that you have to be strong militarily, and basically you can get away with anything. Now, what Jonathan said when talking about African countries,
in theory, Jonathan's absolutely correct, but in reality, they have no choice because they're under risk of being invaded. Ask Muammar Gaddafi's ghost if he should have spent more money on arms, if he should have given up his chemical weapons program in 2003 when he did. Ask the people of Iraq. Ask the people of Iran who are suffering under these barbaric sanctions if they think their country should spend less on arms in order to put up a deterrence against the vultures that are circling their country right now. No, this is all about racism. It's racism writ large. It's colonialism, it's imperialism in our time. And imperialism is the external oppression of white supremacy. And until we move beyond white supremacy, there will be no progress and there will be no emancipation for the entire world.
How do we move beyond, John? How do we move beyond this white supremacy? What's
well, we
key right now?
Beyond it. We are living in a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world and the coming into being of the new. The rise of China, the strategic threat of Russia, that is the new world. The sun is setting in the west and it's rising in the east. But in the period in between is a period of struggle, and it's a very dangerous period because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And that struggle is being waged now. And I just hope that the people of Iran, of Venezuela, of Cuba, of Russia and China continue to hold the line, because people in the West of consciousness and conscience are depending on them to free us all.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this debate. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer out of London and out in Edinburgh. John White, author and commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General, said, "Working in a healthcare facility without water, sanitation, and hygiene is akin to sending nurses and doctors to work without personal protective equipment." He said water supply, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities are fundamental to stopping COVID-19. But there's still major gaps to overcome, particularly in least developed countries. Jennifer Sara, Global Director for Water at the World Bank Group, said, "For millions of healthcare workers across the world, water is personal protective equipment." She added, "It is essential that financing keeps flowing to bring water and sanitation services to those battling the COVID-19 crisis on the front lines." Data published by the World Health Organization, WHO, in October indicates that COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers are far greater than those in the general population. Healthcare workers represent less than 3% of the general population, but account for 14% of global COVID-19 cases reported to the World Health Organization. Ensuring healthcare workers have the basic water, sanitation, and hygiene necessities to keep themselves, their patients, and their families and children safe is imperative. We're prepared for you an article written by staff writers of UNICEF.org under the heading, "UN Report Says Almost 2 Billion Depend on Health Centers Without Basic Water Services." Please stay with us for more of UNICEF.org's article. The World Health Organization, WHO, and the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned around 1.8 billion people are at heightened risk of COVID-19 and other diseases because they use or work in healthcare facilities without basic water services. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General, said, "Working in a healthcare facility without water, without sanitation and hygiene, is akin to sending nurses and doctors to work without personal protective equipment." He said water supply, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities are fundamental to stopping COVID-19 spreading, but there are still major gaps to overcome, particularly in least developed countries. The report, "Fundamentals First: Universal Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Services in Healthcare Facilities for Safe Quality Care," comes as COVID-19 is exposing key vulnerabilities within healthcare systems, including inadequate infection prevention and control. Water, sanitation, and hygiene are vital to the safety of healthcare workers and patients, yet provision of these services is not prioritized. Worldwide, one in four healthcare facilities has no water services. One in three does not have access to hand hygiene, where care is provided. One in 10 has no sanitation services, and one in 3 does not segregate waste safely. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said, "Sending healthcare workers and people in need of treatment to facilities without clean water, without safe toilets or even soap, puts their lives at risk." She said, "This was certainly true before the COVID-19 pandemic, but this year has made these disparities impossible to ignore. As we reimagine and shape a post-COVID world, making sure we are sending children and mothers to places of care equipped with adequate water, sanitation, and hygiene services is not merely something we can and should do. It is an absolute must." The situation is worst of all in the world's 47 least developed countries. One in two healthcare facilities in the least developing countries does not have basic drinking water. One in four healthcare facilities has no hand hygiene facilities at points of care. And three in five lack basic sanitation services. But this can be fixed. The report's preliminary estimate indicates that it would cost roughly $1 per capita to enable all 47 least developed countries to establish basic water service in healthcare facilities. On average, $0.2 per capita is needed each year to operate and maintain services. According to the report, immediate incremental investment in basic water and hygiene and healthcare have big returns. Improving hygiene in healthcare facilities is a best buy for tackling antimicrobial resistance. It reduces healthcare costs because it reduces healthcare-associated infections, which are costly to treat. It saves time as healthcare workers do not have to search for water for hand hygiene. Better hygiene also increases uptake of services. This all adds up to a return of $1.5 for every dollar invested. These services are especially critical for vulnerable populations, including pregnant mothers, newborn babies, and children. Improving water sanitation and hygiene services in healthcare facilities is particularly important around childbirth, when far too many mothers and newborn babies suffer and die, including from preventable conditions. Conditions like sepsis. Better water sanitation and hygiene services could save 1 million pregnant women and newborn babies' lives and reduce stillbirths. The report provides four main recommendations. Implement costed national roadmaps with appropriate financing. Monitor and regularly review progress in improving water, sanitation and hygiene services, practices and enabling environment. Develop capacities to health workforce to sustain water, sanitation and hygiene services and promote and practice good hygiene. Integrate water, sanitation and hygiene into regular health sector planning, budgeting and programming, including COVID-19 response and recovery efforts to deliver quality services. Global water sanitation and hygiene and health partners have shown their support for meeting global and country water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facility targets. By 2020, over 130 partners have committed resources, of which 34 have made dedicated financial commitments totaling $125 million. Nevertheless, implementation of the 2019 World Health Assembly resolution on water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities is uneven. Of the nearly 50 countries for which World Health Organization and UNICEF have data, 86% have updated standards and 70% have conducted initial assessments, which show that these areas are generally on track. Yet just a third of countries have costed national water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facility roadmaps, and only 10% have included water sanitation and hygiene indicators in national health systems monitoring. More catalytic global funding, technical support and domestic resourcing is needed to keep healthcare workers and patients safe and protected. Now an opportunity exists to build on existing efforts and commitments and integrate water, sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities in all national COVID-19 plans, vaccine distribution and economic recovery packages. Jennifer Sara, Global Director for Water at the World Bank Group, said, "For millions of healthcare workers across the world, water is personal protective equipment." She added, "It is essential that finances keep flowing to bring water and sanitation services to those battling the COVID-19 crisis on the front lines. Funding water, sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities is among the most cost-effective investments that governments can make. Data published by the World Health Organization in October indicates that COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers are far greater than those in the general population. Healthcare workers represent less than 3% of the population, but account for 14% of the global COVID-19 cases reported to the World Health Organization. Ensuring healthcare workers have the basic water, sanitation, and hygiene necessities to keep themselves, their patients, and their families and children safe is absolutely imperative. Tim Wainwright, chief executive at international charity WaterAid, said, "Millions have no option but to seek care from the 50% of healthcare facilities in the developing world which don't have clean water on the premises. This cannot continue. Every day, both healthcare workers' and patients' lives are being put at risk." Tim Wainwright added, "Without frontline healthcare workers being able to wash their hands, provide their patients with clean water, or have somewhere decent to go to the toilet, a hospital is not a hospital at all. It's a breeding ground for disease." The data in this year's report includes statistics for 165 countries from surveys representing 760,000 facilities. Compared to last year's baseline report, estimates were available for 125 countries with data from surveys representing 560,000 facilities. The data on county progress in implementing the World Health Assembly's resolution represent 47 countries. It is the first time that these data have been compiled and analyzed.